Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Ever wonder what the slave trade was like in St. Louis? One of our listeners did. Ann Walker, after visiting our website, wrote to Curious Louis and asked this question.
Are information and relics from the slave pen, previously located downtown at the old Bush Stadium, currently being stored at the Missouri History Museum? And is there an exhibit about this work planned, or has it been one there in the past?
Why do you think it's particularly important to preserve physical objects?
In time immemorial, people have been using relics and statues and et cetera to leave their mark on history. So as an African American, most of us didn't have time to sit up and make these relics and statues because we were picking cotton. It's important that the relics that do pertain to us in any sort of way then be maintained.
That's listener Ann Walker talking with producer Char Dastin. Walker is the founder and executive director of Freedom Trails, Legacies of Hope, a local nonprofit dedicated to researching African-American history. Now, to answer her question, with me in studio are Chris Gordon, the librarian at the Missouri History Museum, and Angela Da Silva, an American Cultural Studies professor at Lindenwood University and a historical reenactor. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Chris? Can you answer a question?
Yes. Unfortunately, when those vaults were uncovered back in 1963, they were documented only through photographs. And the actual relics do not exist. It was a time when It was kind of a double situation back then. For one thing, I don't think there was quite the interest in African American history that we have today. And sometimes those types of artifacts, those types of relics, were simply not considered as important, and they were not saved as they should have been. The other thing is the 1960s through the 1970s. In terms of development, people were not that interested in saving the old. The new was the rage. Everything wanted things to be, sparkling and new. They wanted new architecture and things like that. And there was not a real push to save a lot of architectural gems. And so it was kind of a bad situation on two fronts at that time.
That surprises me a lot because 1963 was the beginning of a decade in which civil rights was such an important subject, in which the interest was so profound.
Yeah, but it was very early on, though.
Early on in that process, Angela, you wanted to react to that?
Yes, regarding the. The relics that he's talking about that were not saved, you're absolutely right. And part of the saving it, the city itself, I mean, we're at the height of the civil rights movement, and they were afraid to put this on display. There's a lot of fear that was associated with this. We are trying to correct the sins of the past, so to speak, and to equalize the playing field. And yet those visible reminders was not something people wanted about hanging around. And so I think it was more from that perspective while these things were not kept.
Mm-hmm. What are the artifacts that were lost or that we have photographs of?
There were actual vaults that were found when they started to do the construction of the original Bush Stadium. The vaults had been saved essentially underneath the development of what was then the Meyer Drug Company. And it was interesting because the vaults they looked just like jail cells. They were, thick walls, heavy stone. And so later on, they were simply transformed into storage areas. So they served a purpose later on, when they started doing the construction and they started knocking down the buildings, it became obvious, you know, what these had served as their purpose originally.
You call them vaults. I think they're also referred to as slave pens, where slaves were kept prior to the sale.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. The site was Bernard M. Lynch was the most successful slave trader, slave dealer in the city of St. Louis through the 1840s, 1850s, right up to the Civil War. He had an original location near 4th and Locust, and essentially became so successful he needed a new location. And so he built this new facility, which, you know, he advertised as being, you know, very clean and humane and so forth, although it was simply a jail.
Do we have any sense for how many slaves were bought and sold over any period of time?
Thousands and thousands.
And that is true. One of the things about Bernard M. Lynch is why these slave pens were underground. With the location of the building, there were people living around there. Mm-hmm. And the misery, the corporal punishment, corrections that were administered, this, you know, and the urban legend that has been assigned to this is that when they were doing the construction for Anheuser-Busch, that they had left a piece of equipment on the ground overnight, and it had fallen through the sub-basement underneath the basement to where this was located. And the reasoning being is that the hollering, the crying, the beatings would not disturb the people that lived around the slave pen. But there is a modicum of justice here regarding this particular site, because under the Union occupation of St. Louis during the Civil War, Bernard M. Lynch's slave pen turned into a prison for the same people who went there shopping. And so they were now on the other side of those bars. Mm. And so there is, like I said, there's a modicum of justice. It was built as such a sort of fortification that nobody was ever escaped. And the same reason with the Southern sympathizers who were held there afterwards. Also, too, there was another purpose that Bernard M. Lynch's slave pen held, and that it was curfew violation. That was one of the few black codes that was severely enforced in St. Louis. And blacks, slave and free, had to be off the street at a certain time during the weekday and a certain time, like I think it was 11 p.m. on the weekends and maybe 8 p.m. during the weekdays. If I, as a free black, could not get off the street and be in curfew violation, I would have to sign myself in the Bernard M. Lynch's slave pen to escape the 39 lashes for curfew violation. So, and he would charge a dollar, what he called room and board, for the night. Now, a room would be just, you know, you would be in the pen. That's number one. And then number two, board would be maybe a drink of water. But you would be, you know, but you paid him for protection.
I want to come back to you on some of this, but I want to turn to Chris for a second here. With regard to dollars and cents of the day, what was a slave sold for? Do we have records of what the pricing was like?
Yes, we do. We know from sources from the time that a slave, there was a number of factors that determined the slave's value. Age, gender, there was, but on average, it could be anywhere from $750 to $1,500, $1,800, right, which is a considerable amount of sum of money at that time. You know, Angela had mentioned about the justice. Lynch himself was enslaved in his own slave pens at the beginning of the war. He had a reputation as being outspoken, and so he did not go quietly, essentially, and ended up sitting in his own jail cell. And when he was finally released, he took off.
That's true.
Nobody ever saw him again.
What I wanted to come back to with you, Angela, is I've seen a video your performance during a reenactment of a slave sale.
That's correct.
And there are a couple of things about that impressed me. First, tell us what the process was like.
We had to search far and wide, number one, for a auctioneer in the what they call the tobacco tradition. And that, and instead of the English tradition, which we're now very much accustomed to, but that's the very fast talking. And we really had to, I really had a lot of conversations with him, and he had to do a lot of soul searching to be able to do this. But in the end, everyone who participated felt that the historical value of this could not be overlooked. And I can tell you the night before, there was approximately 35 people that were involved in that. Most of them from the Blue-Gray Alliance, which is Civil War reenactors on both sides. As you saw in the video, there were reenactors to really, I mean, families brought in farm animals and, you know, and authentic wagons that came out of two museums from Mississippi and, you know, it took a lot. The night before, we all got together. And again, this was planned by the minute because we had to anticipate how the crowd was going to act. And if A happened, then our response was going to be what? And so we decided that this whole thing couldn't be over 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. But as you saw from the beginning, we had chains forged in the slave tradition by a blacksmith over in Illinois who used replicas from museum. And we started at Lynch's Slave Pen. The city allowed us to close off the street. We started and rattling those chains, walking up to the courthouse, which was something that would have happened. And the night before, we all got together and seriously prayed over this because we had no idea. It had not been done since, for over 25 years. And when it was done before by a very big tourist organization, they had their lunch handed to them. And a lot of people reminded me of that. And but I was bound and determined to do it because in 2011, when this was done, it was the kickoff of the sesquicentennial of the Civil War. And every cultural institution in St. Louis was meeting about how they were going to handle it. But never once going to those meetings did people talk about slavery. Mm-hmm. So I had to put it back on the table.
I was struck by the emotion that you felt in going through this. I mean, as a person of color, reenacting something that had happened 150 years earlier, it's moved you greatly, didn't it?
Yes, it did. But it wasn't just me. Mm-hmm. It was the members from the Blue-Gray Alliance. Those guys, they, from the white perspective, I don't think they expected to feel what they felt either. And there was a lot of remorse. There was a lot of guilt. But everybody in the end at the wrap-up session was awfully happy that we did it. But we all agreed we never would do it again. Mm-hmm. Okay, there was no two ways about that. Okay, it just drained you. And in my case, when the president of the Blue-Gray Alliance is looking at my teeth and my eyes and calling me auntie and how many children had I raised and could I cook and this, all of these questions and, you know, had me, you know, hopping on one foot to show that I was still agile at my age. That was all planned. I mean, we mm-hmm. had to do this and be as real as possible.
Roger. Chris, what do you, have you seen the film?
No, I have not.
Yeah. What was the frequency of these sales? I mean, there's obviously it wasn't every day, but it was probably fairly frequent.
Yeah, it was at least a weekly event, and they were held over at the old courthouse.
Irony there as well, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. In a democracy, we have this going on the steps of the federal courthouse. And they were very obviously they were public auctions. They were very public events. Mm-hmm. So anyone walking by on the street would witness this, and it obviously made an impression on people and turned some people against slavery. Just seeing how this unfolded,
Carter G. Woodson The father of Black history, if you will, stated that because that the gang labor crop of Missouri was slave breeding, we didn't have cotton. We had hemp, we had tobacco, and a long highway around Highway 79, we had rice for those plantations up there. But slave breeding, so those auctions took place both public and private a lot more frequently here because the slaves from Missouri were sold to the Deep South.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Chris, what has the History Museum done with regard to this period? Is there anything current there now that reflects this time that we're talking about?
Well, right now we have the number one in civil rights exhibit up at the moment. And it does deal with the early freedom suits and some of the attempts at resisting slavery and attempting to get freedom through the legal system and so forth. When the sesquicentennial of the Civil War was coming around in 2011, we did have a Civil War in Missouri exhibit up, and that did include the one artifact that we do have from Lynch's slave pen, which is the cash box from Lynch's office. And it's kind of an interesting story. Again, Lynch realized that he was not a popular character here. After the beginning of the Civil War, he flees, and he literally leaves everything behind.
Where did he go? Do we know? You just explained what you just did.
Yeah, he went south, deep south.
Okay. Yeah, deep south. Right, yeah. The one source that I read said that he had a farm in Tennessee, and he goes back to Tennessee, and he essentially dies there later on. He leaves everything behind, and the last clerk to work in his office decides that the cash box was the most interesting thing and worth saving. And about 100 years ago, that same individual donated it to the Missouri Historical Society. So we still have it in the collection, and that was on display during the Civil War exhibit.
Time is winding down, but we have a caller here who wants to get into the conversation. Tom is in Kirkwood. Tom, a question or comment, but quickly, please.
Yes. The History Museum does a great job highlighting, but it is a museum, and lots of times it's hard to get into those spaces. So my question is, and this was highlighted by Michael Moore's Where to Invade Next, in Germany, they actually put up signs from the Holocaust, World War II, on the streets about kind of advertising what was going on at the times. Is there any plans to get what you do at the History Museum out actually on the streets in any way to kind of raise more awareness about that? I just really thought it was a really poignant opportunity for St. Louis to do something like that.
Thanks, Tom.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly we do a lot of programming, and we have plans certainly to be more visible in the very near future in terms of online and marketing and advertising and so forth. But as far as and I assume he's talking about kind of off-site exhibits. We try to work with other organizations and things like that to highlight these types of issues. So it's a matter of partnerships and working with other organizations.
Right. What they did in Germany was they put street signs up where events happened, things happened related to the Holocaust, and would just say this happened here.
Historical
so it's a constant reminder of what happened. Mm-hmm. Time is winding down. Angela, with the research that you've done, is there any indication that this slave trade was handled any differently here in St. Louis than it was in other places?
Yes, several, and I have to pull out just a little bit. We know that the Boones, one of Daniel Boone's sons, was a slave trader. And we also know that certain times of the year, slave traders came from the South. They would book suites in hotels and advertise they're going to be in St. Louis on this date. If you have someone to sell, you know, I'm going to be here from these dates. And that, when you look at the newspapers from the time, you will see quite a few of these. And then we have to talk about, for example, which is outside of St. Louis, but James P. Hicklin up in Lexington, Missouri, had an annual spring sale where he was a slave breeder here, one of the largest. And every spring he would advertise throughout the South. And this is a case where planters came here. And they would stay at St. Louis and then go to the sale. But yes, it was equally it was handled just like in the Deep South, but I would say more frequently because of our location, and that slaves were actually bred here to be sent south.
It was a bustling commerce, Chris.
Yes.
Yeah, and the advertisement that advertisements she's referring to, they'll say, you know, we're looking for 300 individuals.
Yes.
You know, they're really looking for high numbers of enslaved people.
Do we have any idea of how much Mr. Lynch, what kind of a fortune he amassed doing all of this? And I've only got a few seconds. We probably don't.
Well, if he did, it didn't help him in the end. So.
And it was probably confiscated by the union.
Yeah.
I'm advised, by the way, that on our website we'll have more information with regard to historic markings and places of interest in connection with all of this. Mm. Angela, I want to thank you so much for being with us. That's Angela DeSilva, an educator and a reenactor, if you will, and Chris Gordon from the Missouri History Museum. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Fascinating discussion. There's so much we need to know about our history, isn't there? Thank you all. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.